Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers cannot pass whatever legislation they like? This is the Overton window at work. The idea, coined by the Mackinac Center's Joe Overton, describes the range of ideas that are politically acceptable at any point in time. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look as issues go from being unthinkable to plausible to policy and talk to the people who change what is possible in politics. Now, I know our podcast audience are going to be people who consume a lot of news and commentary, and today's guest might be someone you turn to. It's Jonah Goldberg, the purveyor of words through columns, books, television, and podcasts, and he is the author and co-founder of The Dispatch, a digital media company. Jonah, welcome.
It's great to be here. I think you said I'm the author of The Dispatch. I'm the editor-in-chief, but that's
editor and co-founder, I think, is what there I was trying to get to. Thank you. What would you say you do around here?
Well, on any given day, so I wear a bunch of different hats. I'm a CNN guy, a commentator. I have an LA Times column for the last 20 years. And I'm an American Enterprise Institute guy. I'm writing a book. But, The Dispatch is one of the reasons why I left National Review. Love National Review. Some of my best friends are still there. But among the reasons I left was a lot of my heroes in the conservative movement had started institutions. And I thought that was one thing that I was the founder of National Review Online, founding editor, but it was something that I thought we needed some new institutions on the right. We needed to model more behavior that was lacking on the right. And we thought there was a real market gap for the kind of news and commentary that we wanted to do in The Dispatch. So I hate to give short shrift to the other parts of my life that are part of the Jonah Goldberg portfolio, but The Dispatch is sort of out front.
Well, let me talk about some of that. So you've got a columnist. I feel like that's an opportunity that you worked hard for. You built up some work and they're like, hey, can you do this for me? I think that's probably the same thing with the CNN commentary. They saw you on TV, liked what you had to offer, made you an offer. Books are a weird thing because you have to give a lot of your life to doing that, but you also need a publisher who's going to give you the opportunity. The Dispatch is a little bit different. It says this is now your baby and you get to figure out what you want to do, what you want to accomplish, and determine your standards of success.
That's right. That's right. And, when Steve Hayes, the co-founder, and I started this thing, we were basically on the same page, which was that if we could be a dollar in the black at the end of the year and accomplish the journalistic things that we wanted to accomplish, then we'd be happy. Over time, that's changed a little bit insofar as we think it's also valuable to prove that you can do non sort of clickbaity, non partisan water carrying journalism and have it be a successful business. And also, we've just put so much sweat equity in the thing. It would be nice if there was a payoff one day. Look, I'm a big believer in the role of institutions. My friend and colleague Yuval Levin has been talking about this for a very long time about how institutions mold character. And one of the things we want to do is train up a bunch of young journalists in how to sort of resist the temptations of where a lot of the incentive structure is in journalism these days, which is to sort of be loud, be brash, be provocative without having the facts on your side, to be rude for its own rudeness for its own sake. And also, even among the best conservative journalists, one of the problems that conservatism has gotten itself into, I would argue and have argued for a long time, is that it's sort of the dog that caught the car insofar as a lot of people, smart people, decent people, close friends of mine, they sort of see their job as conservative intellectuals and writers slightly differently than I do, insofar as they think that part of their job is to craft arguments to help the Republican Party, to defend the Republican Party, to find the sweet spot for the Republican Party. And some of those things are perfectly legitimate, right? People write about the politics that they want. But every now and then you'll hear, again, And good friends of mine.
American
say things like
basically gives you two choices.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not trying to be like they're bad and I'm good or anything like that. I'm just saying I've lost my rooting interest. I'm a conservative, but I've lost my rooting interest in the Republican Party these days. And when I talk about the coming midterms, I try really hard not to say things like, well, we might not have a good night. And there are a lot of conservative writers and intellectuals who still talk about the plural we when they're talking about the Republican Party. And I think we have enough of that kind of journalism, whatever you think of it. Steve and I wanted to come up with something else where we don't carry water for Democrats or Republicans. And you can tell from the reaction by a lot of people that when you don't carry water for Republicans, they assume you're carrying it for the Democrats. And when you don't carry water for the Democrats, they assume you're carrying it for the Republicans. And I think that is the fault of the consumer, not of the provider in our case.
Yes, it's a shortcut. And you either have to make those assumptions or deal with the arguments the person is making. I think we'd be a lot better off if we have to deal with the arguments more, have a good faith effort to try and understand issues and ideas and what policies the nation, our states, and our local government should enact.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that entirely. I just like arguments. Mm-hmm. And I think that politics is supposed to be about arguments. I think democracy is about disagreement, not about agreement. And too much of our politics, including a lot of our political journalism, is essentially different versions of what they used to call the popular front mentality. And I don't like the popular front mentality.
What are some of the journalistic things you want to accomplish with the Dispatch?
Well, so part of our philosophy from the beginning was to look at what they, you know, term of our market gaps, right? Where places where we thought the consumer, the gettable consumer for us was underserved by the existing offers, you know, in the marketplace. And so one of the examples I used a lot when we were raising money and building the thing up was climate change. Now, look, I'm sort of with Matt Ridley on this. I think climate change is real, but I'm not a catastrophist about it. I'm a lukewarmer kind of guy on this. I think it's important. It's worth studying. I'm not sure it's worth completely reorganizing the global economy at this given moment. I think the Green New Deal is hot garbage, but I also don't think it's a fraud, and as exaggerated as it might be. Regardless, if you actually go around and you look at a lot of the mainstream media, they don't have environmental reporters. They just have climate change reporters. And even there's almost no environmental story that doesn't have at least two paragraphs of the "to be sure, climate change is making it worse." And meanwhile, I think there's a lot of environmental and conservation stuff that doesn't get covered or gets undercovered because it doesn't have a climate change angle to it. And I have relatives, I have friends who live in like very red parts of the country who think climate change is a hoax. Again, I think they're wrong, but that doesn't mean they don't care about land rights, water usage, hunting, fishing, all sorts of other things, forestry that are really, really important. And yet it's very difficult for them to find anything useful written about that. And so we've started to go into that with this thing called Dispatch Energy, which is sort of related to this. It was a way we could figure out how to get funded, build out that beat. But that's sort of our approach to a lot of things. We started Dispatch Faith, which is a Sunday product. And the assumption there was there are a lot of sincerely religious people who get really tired and fed up with reading the New York Times and other national publications covering religion purely through the prism of Donald Trump and Washington, D.C. There are other things going on in that space. There are other issues to discuss. And so that's how we see things. As we see, you know, we're still growing, but we think there are a lot of underserved constituencies that we think a center-right publication can address while maintaining its credibility as being sort of fact-driven and that kind of thing.
Why should people subscribe to the Dispatch?
Well, first of all, because it'll make all the right people angry. No, that's a very contemporary way of thinking about things. Yeah. Because we are in a time and a place where a lot of people bemoan that they can't trust the news. They bemoan that people don't, that journalists don't care about the facts. That to be in the media has to mean you're left wing and therefore, you know, an enemy of this, that, or the other thing, or that to be conservative means just simply to be a partisan Republican. And we don't agree with any of these things. And that's what I was getting at earlier about trying to model the behavior we think is lacking out there. We have a rule. We have several, you know, center-left people on our masthead on the contributing side, because in today's political climate, I can have a more meaningful, interesting conversation with somebody who's fact-driven, policy-driven, who cares about the truth on the center left than I can with a lot of people who are ostensibly flying under the same flag as me. And we have a sort of unwritten rule, the Dispatch, that if we're not pissing off about 30% of our readership on any given day, we're doing something wrong. And so I think on the one hand, I think we provide a fantastic value for the Morning Dispatch. I think is the best newsletter in the business, in terms of actually summarizing and bringing you the news. And also you would be rewarding people who are trying to do this the hard way rather than do this the easy way. And I think you provide an enormous amount of value for it.
Let me throw another one, which is again, why I'm a fan of the publication. Do you want to live in a country where you treat your fellow citizens as neighbors to be persuaded or as obstacles to be overcome? If that's the kind of nation you want to be in, Dispatch will give you a lot.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. I didn't know we were going to do all this Dispatch pitching. I would have been more polished in all of this. I usually leave this sort of front of the house stuff to Steve Hayes, who lives and breathes it, but I'm happy to do it.
Well, that's the shtick for the podcast. Like, this is an effort. You are, in fact, trying to change something. It's sometimes tough in the day-to-day to take a step back and say, where are we headed? Why are we doing this? What are we trying to accomplish? But that's the shtick of the podcast, because these are the type of things that do change the bounds of the Overton window. We live in a very polarized world. The media environment is constantly changing, but it is very antagonistic because outrage sells. And you do sell some outrage.
Yeah, we have some outrage. I mean, Nick Kitojo is a very passionate critic of Donald Trump. Kevin Williamson cannot keep his outrage in check. These are guys on the opinion side. I think on our news side, our reporting side, we keep a lot of that stuff in check pretty well. But what we don't do, I don't think, is do what a lot of media outlets do, is tell their audiences what they think they want to hear rather than what they need to hear. And, you know, we'll do stuff on, you know, Civil War in Chad as our main news item in the Morning Dispatch. If we think it's important, we think it's important. And we think we've earned the trust from our readers to believe us when we say it's important and that kind of thing. I've never been, I mean, just to back up for a second, I was never a big journalistic ethics guy. I believe in ethics. I'm just saying that, like, I find a lot of, like, the Columbia Journalism School universe to be essentially a glorified guild where it's more about getting the access to jobs. The people who graduated from Columbia Journalism School tend to want to hire people from Columbia Journalism School. And they tend to create lots of rules and complexity about journalism that serve as a barrier to entry for other people. I think American journalism was in better shape when you could have a high school diploma and become a journalist. But the one thing I absolutely passionately believed in, which I assumed everybody else did too, circa 2015, 2016, was you shouldn't lie. You just shouldn't say things that you don't believe to be true. You shouldn't write things that you don't believe to be true. And it was the experience of witnessing so many people who I thought had the same job description as me disagree with that they thought they were sort of part of their job was to be party operatives, that made me want to start the Dispatch. And and it's been a great success and a great ride so far.
So you've mentioned that there has been a change in the media landscape, and you are trying to do fact-based argumentation, good faith presentations. Give some people something to chew on. Is this going back to a better debate that we used to have, or are you trying something new? I mean, a lot of people lament the good old days when media was something else. I've never been that persuaded, had its own problems. There are new problems too.
I agree. It's always had problems. I think it's an interesting question. I mean, one of the things to keep in mind is that so America, because Americans love technology, fell in love with the idea of objective journalism. Really, it was started with the telegraph, but then it became really instantiated in a certain sort of post-World War II elite group with the advent of television, which is this idea that you can just simply describe the facts without any insertion of your own opinion or analysis and or biases. And it's worth noting that a lot of the European press never bought into that. So, like, you know, the London, which is a thriving, wonderful newspaper culture, or at least has for a very long time, you know, the Times was Tory and the Guardian was Bolshevik and the Telegraph was sort of working class conservative, you know, like different categories, but they were also good newspapers and you knew where they were coming from, and it helped you sort of process where the framing that they brought. In America, there was this tendency to sort of try to hide the framing. You know, Walter Cronkite would end the CBS Evening News with the statement, "And that's the way it is." It wasn't, "And that's the news we think you need," or "That's how we see it." It was, you know, they used to call that position the voice of God, or the eye of God position at to be anchor of an evening news show. The New York Times insisted that they had all the news that's fit to print, right? And I have always argued, long before the current crazy times, that the best journalism in America has always been high-minded, serious opinion journalism. The long-form essay in the New Republic or the New Yorker or National Review that makes an argument and tries to address the other side's best arguments, not their weakest arguments, is the best form of journalism. And people always look at me like that's kind of crazy. And, you know, there are a couple of reasons why I say that. One is the cult of objectivity is a very hard one to actually realize. News organizations have a lot of groupthink. The mere act of where you put quotes from both sides in the article is an act of bias, and it's unavoidable. If you put your, like, and the other side says X 15 paragraphs later, half your readers aren't going to have read it. And so you're front loading the things you want people to know. That is an inherently biased exercise, and there's no getting around it. And it's not left-wing bias or right-wing bias. It's just bias. It's impossible, given the nature of the space-time continuum, to do it any other way. And meanwhile, when I say this about making an argument, people say, well, that's bias. That's not reporting. That's not objectivity. And we have these arguments internally at the Dispatch as well, because, you know, we try to do more conventional, normal reporting on the reporting side. But my point is, what is the single most obvious and respected forum for getting to the truth in mainstream American life? And it's not Congress. It's the courts. And what are courts? They're adversarial proceedings where each side is making an argument. The prosecution is biased towards conviction. The defense is biased towards acquittal. There are rules about you have to be telling the truth. You have to bring facts. You have to deal with the other side's best arguments or you're going to lose. And it's adversarial, and adversarial arguments are better at getting at the truth than this sort of watered down, namby-pamby, Some say X, some say Y stuff. And so that's always been my preference about this kind of thing. And I agree with you. The myth of a golden age of objective journalism is exactly that, a myth. Doesn't mean all the journalism was bad. But, you know, the CBS, Walter Cronkite, CBS News, reported, Daniel Shore, their chief correspondent, reported that Barry Goldwater, who was on like on a vacation with his family, visiting like his father-in-law in Germany or something like that, was actually in a clandestine effort to go meet up with neo-Nazi elements so they could coordinate the fall campaign in 1964. It was just a complete lie, and he sued and he won. Dan Rather.
Which is tough to do as a political figure.
Really tough to do as a political figure. Dan Rather beclowned himself repeatedly as supposedly this avatar of objective journalism. And so the part of the problem with the objective journalism thing is it just invites groupthink. And Dan Rather would have been in such better shape if there was just one person at 60 Minutes when he did that Memogate thing, we don't have to get into all the details, who didn't want the story to be true. But when everybody wants the story to be true, it turns out that some things are too good to check, and you run with it. If you have somebody in the room who says, whoa, this feels wrong, even for partisan reasons, you're going to get better journalism out of it. And anyway, so I can do the journalism thing all day long. I don't know if listeners really care about it, though.
Well, actually, I want you to get in the realm of speculative opportunities, which is, how many people do you need to get what you want? Like, you want this better political debate. You want it to matter for politics. You want it to help people understand what's going on in America, to form their opinions. How many people do you need to subscribe?
We think what do they call it? Total attainable market, in a TAM or whatever they call that. When we go through the numbers, we think there are probably a couple million people who could be persuaded to be Dispatch subscribers. We'll settle right now for 100,000 subscribers. That would be a step change kind of difference for us. And we're on our way, but growth has been hard in terms of subscribers. There's a lot of email fatigue. There's all sorts of other things going on. We're steadily growing. A lot of other places are shrinking, but the growth has not been as aggressive as we hoped and we would like. But the trend lines are good. I would say, you know, to broaden out the point a little bit, my friend George Will loves to say,
also a guest on this podcast,
small ideologically committed minorities change the world and drive events. And I think he is absolutely correct about that. I think one of the problems with saying that is that there are a lot of small ideologically committed minorities who fail. And we tend to, there's a sort of winner's bias that makes it, well, look at the Bolsheviks, right? Look at the Federalist Society. Look at, you know, these groups and say,
play the lottery, you win.
That's right. There are also the Shakers, didn't turn out so well. But there's a reason why I have a podcast through the Dispatch called The Remnant. And, part of it is on the intellectual side of me is I am fairly content to admit that I am not part of the mainstream right these days. I also think, the part of the point of the image of the remnant, which is partly a reference to Albert J. Nock, is an essay that he wrote, is that remnants are vestiges of something that came from before. But they're also, in biblical terms, the seed stock for something to come, right? They're the thing that you build on. And I think there are an enormous number of people in this country, whether they become Dispatch subscribers or not, I think there are an enormous number of people in this country who don't like the way things are and are hungry for sane people having sane and serious arguments about sane and serious things. And we want to be part of that process that helps us get there. I mean, I personally resent that I have to be like this grown-up, guy. I was always the guy that the grown-ups told, maybe you're working a little too blue. That's not the language we want. I was always the one who had to be restrained. And now all of a sudden, I really resent having to be like the finger wagger at other people. But I think, you know, if we could hit 100,000 paid subscribers, if we could get another, I mean, our podcasts do very well, but you get these things at scale that all of a sudden make you more attractive to advertisers, more attractive for event things. They give you the kind of bandwidth that lets you do more stuff, have more beats, hire more reporters. And we'd like to get there. And so, I mean, I didn't know I was going to be doing the straight pitch, you know, subscribe now kind of thing. I can come up and give you guys a promo code later if you like.
We might put this in the write-up if you got one for us.
Sure.
But although I do think the volume being is an important thing. And there's a thing in vehicles, there's no replacement for displacement.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Bigger cylinders matter.
Yeah, it's also, I use this mostly in the context of the phrase, I use this phrase mostly in the context of the Ukraine war, but it's also true in other places that quality is better than quantity, but quantity has a quality all of its own. And if you have enough subscribers, I don't think we would feel inclined to lower the quality, but it just allows you to, it allows you to just do so much more if you can get that kind of scale. So,
so you mentioned that you recognize that your audience, like it's a couple million people, 340 million people, not a big one. You'd like to get to even just a fraction of what you think you, what you can. You're trying to produce the kind of product that will attract people, getting your voice out there in a number of different outlets, including our podcast, although I assume we have a far smaller reach than you. But are you ultimately betting on something that was mentioned in that weird movie Vanilla Sky? Tom Cruise's character gets approached by like his father's old business consultant, and he says, "They're betting that you're stupid, but I know something. That's that people will read again."
Herbstein called this thing called Stein's Law. Herbstein was Nixon's chief counsel of economic advisors. He was the head of the economics department at AI after that. And Stein's Law simply says that which cannot go on forever must eventually stop. And I think there are a lot of things going on now that are just not sustainable. And I want to be like, look, I mean, I want to be clear, like, when you say people will read again, I think people, not everybody has to read, you know, but there are, and this idea then like in the 18th or 19th century, you know, Americans were sitting around, all of them were just reading Moby Dick and whatnot, has always been sort of imaginary. But we think that there are, I put it this way, I think there are a lot of serious people in this country who feel ill-served by a lot of the mainstream media, by a lot of right-wing media, by and by our political system, and they want to take their citizenship seriously, but they're also busy doing other things. Our, you know, we talk about this all the time, is about our model reader subscriber for us is like a ER surgeon in Oregon who, you know, went to a good school, clearly educated, clearly smart, very busy, and doesn't want to waste their time. And so one of the rules we have is just not to waste the reader's time or the listener's time. I mean, we do have ads on our podcasts, but we have, as of now, we have virtually no advertising on our paid products, you know, on our subscriber products. Not because I think it would corrupt us. You know, Steve and I, this is one of the few things we disagree on. Steve thinks that clickbait advertising, internet advertising creates bad incentives because it's all about getting more traffic, which is more eyeballs, which means you end up with, you know, Huffington Post style galleries of side boob shots at the Oscars. And like, my view is, I think we could resist that. I was at National Review for 20 years. We were not corrupted by advertising. But I do think that the clickbait kind of volume traffic model destroys the user experience. And so there are a lot of great people at the Washington Examiner. I found it almost impossible to read the site because I'm just constantly barraged by, you know, pop-ups and autoplay videos and all of that kind of stuff. And so one of the things we try to do is sort of slow things down for the reader. They don't feel like they have to come to the site 15 times a day or anything like that. But more broadly, I just think, look, there is the current way we do news and consume news and do politics is not sustainable for a great country. And so I think it'll change. Edmund Burke has this line where he says, example is the school of mankind and he will learn it no other. I often say that Ed Koch said it better. Ed Koch was the mayor of New York City who, when he ran for a third term and lost, he was asked if he was ever going to run again. And he said, no, the people of New York fired me and now they must be punished. And I think there are a lot of people who are sick of the status quo, who are sick of the sort of populist bubble, and want to read series. Like the fact that The Atlantic has a million subscribers now is kind of, we think of ourselves as sort of an embryonic right of center version of The Atlantic in some ways. Long time before we can get to where they are, but the fact that they are where they are and they take their, you know, they take their mission seriously is a good example for us. And, you know, I think a lot of our other problems are not things that the Dispatch can fix, no matter how successful. All we can do is help other people fix it by making arguments, right? I mean, I think the primary system is probably more responsible for the craptacular nature of American politics than anything going on in journalism, because a lot of the journalism that we get is responsive to the kind of parties we have, and the parties we have suck because of the primary system. But it's very, so like, you know, talking about an Overton window topic, getting rid of primaries. It's very difficult to have that conversation right now because of the fetishization of democracy inside of parties. I'm very pro-democracy, but it used to be considered the thing between parties, not within parties. Similarly, I just talking to Yuval Levin about this on my podcast. I think it was a catastrophe for governance to put cameras in Congress. It didn't seem so. I didn't think that when it happened in the 1990s, when it started in the 1990s, but it is now. And figuring out ways to allow Congress to work the way it's supposed to work is another one of these sort of Overton kind of things where, like, I would be entirely in favor of banning cameras. I don't think it's politically possible to do, but starting that argument about why it's had unintended consequences is valuable. And that's the kind of thing we talk about a lot at the Dispatch.
So to kind of go for what you might be betting on, it's not the people will read again. It's the people will ask for depth in politics again.
Yeah. I mean, look, there, I'll be honest, you know, there are eggheads who take this too far. I think, you know, there are some, I don't want to name names, but there are some think tanky types who think all meaningful policy and political change, it really happens at the elite level, where you don't really need to convince the masses. You need to convince, you know, a comparative handful of elites in government, in media, in industry, and then they move the Overton window for you, right? I think that there are overstated versions of that. And I try not to overstate them. I do think that not all readers are equal when it comes to changing public policy arguments, right? And if you dumb things down to a lowest common denominator, the people who take their citizenship seriously or who take public policy seriously, who influence public policy, who vote reliably and seriously, you're not going to get many of them fairly quickly because they're going to want something at a higher level. We're not trying to like be wildly technical and elitist about anything by any stretch of the imagination, but we're also not trying to do the lowest common denominator, stuff. We expect the reader, we expect more of our readers because we say expect more of ourselves, I think is one way to put it.
Well, Jonah, good luck on your attempt to get maturity back into politics. And I think if you do, it will definitely change the way this country works.
Thank you. I'm really glad to have done this, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to have pitched the Dispatch.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.